Hello, everyone, and welcome to MetaHustler Podcast Season 4, Episode 7. We are back with our Mono episodes. It is Thursday, December 21st, and we are
getting pretty much close to
close to Christmas and end of the year. But I'm Vic Aslanian, your host, and this is my amazing co-host, Mr. Mark Balian, where we discuss our great Armenian history, covering different eras, topics, and people. If you're watching us on YouTube, please make sure you hit that like button. You are subscribed and share with friends and family. And if you're listening to us on your favorite podcast platform, please make sure you go ahead and give us a review, hopefully a five-star review. Share with friends, family, let them know about this great podcast that you listen to. Today's episode, we're going to be covering the final reign, which is King Gagik II and the end of the Bagratuni era.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. But before we dive into it, we know the holidays are here, so we want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas and a happy, safe New Year.
New Year.
We hope that 2024 brings everybody
Everything better than 2023 and 2022 and 2021 on and so forth.
I mean it's been a tough 3 years for the Armenian community.
Armenia,
the diaspora, it's been tough, and we all share the same pain, but we have to stay positive, we have to stay healthy, and there's a lot of work to be done for the future of our nation, our motherland, and us as a people. So again, we wish the best to everybody, but the number one thing is we wish all of you health, because without health, nothing matters.
Absolutely. So,
our last episode, it was a heavy topic. We were live with Vigen Arabian and Edgar Akopian, who are the founders of Support Our Heroes Armenia NGO. We talked about everything that has taken place with the situation in Artsakh. So if you guys missed that episode, or if you haven't listened to it, go back, listen to it. And if you can, support their organization, because they are doing everything they can to help the displaced
families. A lot of families.
Yeah. So, besides that, if you guys want to support the show, very important. We mention this all the time. Please consider becoming a Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/methedosner and support us as little as $5 a month. And it helps us with production costs and everything else that we are doing, side projects. I mentioned last show, we are going to be launching the Haik Nahapet sculpture. We had a little bit of a delay, so we'll probably release that either next week or coming year. There's so much involved in it, but we're just waiting for the final okay from the manufacturer, and then we'll move forward and we'll announce how this is going to be sold. Like we mentioned, it's going to be in batches, so forth, and all the profits are going to go to Hike for Our Heroes organization. Besides that, what else? Oh, and if you guys want the other sculptures, you can go to our website, metahostnet.com, and purchase the sculpture that you like. You can get it as a gift for somebody who is a diehard Armenian history fan. That also supports us as well.
Yep, and what we're trying to do.
Yeah, but so this is going to be our last episode for 2023. And then we'll be back next year with a very interesting show. A gentleman will be joining us, and we're going to be talking about the true unheard story somewhat of Solomon Telerian and everything that took place.
That's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, he's a very interesting gentleman that I was introduced to, and he has a very...
treasure trove of information.
Yeah, treasure information, and
we'll leave it at that
story. So, but we'll be back here with that episode, and then we have some other people who are going to be guests. So, we'll be announcing those. So make sure you're following us on Instagram, which is at MedHeadosNet, and we'll announce those dates as soon as they are available. But anyways, so you ready?
Dum-dum-dum-dum.
All right. So like I said, this episode is titled The Final Reign, King Gagik II, and the End of the Bagratuni Empire, or era, I should say.
Yeah.
So let's go back to our historical deep dive into the Bagratuni reign, I guess. Today we're going to talk about the particular terminus period of the Armenian history. Let's kind of start with where we left off on episode 5, the joint reign of Sambat the 3rd and Ashot the 4th, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Ashot the 4th in the central Bagratuni kingdom. They were, you know, they were the
Ashot 3rd.
Ashot the 3rd?
Yeah.
I'm forgetting now.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, it gets kind of confusing sometimes, but
Ashot the 3rd. But, yeah, so, I mean, it was quite a challenging time, two brothers ruling. It's that's where we kind of left off, and now we're going to talk about this also. We are also not going to just talk about King Gagik II, because that was a short reign. We're also going to go into and talk about what happened after he died and the whole Byzantine fiasco that happened, plus the Seljuk invasion of Armenia and what took place. So we're going to cover those two important, because it is part of, you know, once the Bagratuni reign ended, this is kind of, this is what took place.
Yeah. You know, you're kind of having what's going on with the Byzantine Empire, more or less annexing Ani, right?
Yeah.
Like we talked about last time, and other places like Taron, Taik, Vaspurakan. On the other hand, we have the Seljuks.
Yeah.
Coming in from, you know, the south and the east and whatnot, moving west, and they were, you know, they're the conquerors, the raiders, so to speak. Not the football raiders. that's kind of where they got their name from, if you really think about it. But they're raiders, they're marauders. They came in and ravaged, pillaged. You know, we all know what they were like. I mean, they've been like this for centuries, but this is what was going on. You have a power from the West, the Byzantine Empire, who undoubtedly, as we'll talk about in a little bit, is going to make a lot of power moves on their end.
Yeah.
But then you have the raiders, so to speak, from the other side.
Yeah.
And now you get into the 11th century politics.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Now, things took a dramatic turn after the death of Sambat and Ashot. In 1041, we see David the Landless. I love that name.
Yeah.
From the neighboring Dashid kingdom, trying to take the crown of the central Bagratuni kingdom. He even marched on to Shirak.
Yeah. But the, you know, our favorite people, the Naharars, or the nobles, they had other plans. They rejected David's candidacy in 1042. So he's not only landless, but he's also without candidacy now. Instead they crowned Gagik II, the 18-year-old son of Ashot the 4th, as the new king. You're really starting to get, you're going to get an idea of how there were these power struggles. I mean, not that we haven't discussed these type of power struggles before, but this is a lot of politics from a lot of different sides.
Yeah, a lot
of different sides, man.
Oh, man. And the last years of the Bagratuni kingdom, Armenia's fate was in the hands of five men. You got King Gagik II, Magister Gregory Palavuni, Varam Sparapet, Catholicos Peter the First, Getadarts, and Vest Sarkis. Their interactions and struggles were crucial for the future of the Bagratuni dynasty.
Yeah. So we call them the Patriots, but even within this Patriot group, there was somewhat of a split. Right. You had the Patriots faction, led by the first three that you mentioned, King Gagik II,
Magister Gregory Pallavuni and Vadim Svarapet, right? Who favored merging with Byzantium or the Byzantine Empire. They've been labeled by historians as the Byzantophile camp. Lack for a better phrase, I suppose. But Byzantophile camp.
Yeah.
So proud. But
this doesn't sound right though.
I know, right? Yeah.
You Byzantophile.
You Byzantophile. But
you're a Byzantophile.
You're a Byzantophile. Anyway, we're enough goofing up. But it's not as black and white as it seems.
Yeah, you're definitely right. It's not. Historians like Karen Yuzbashian argue that labeling Peter the First and Vesarkis as traitors is not too simplistic. They believed in strengthening Armenia by aligning with the Byzantine Empire, which was friendly neighbor or whatever you want to call it, due to the deep integration of Armenian elites within the Byzantine Empire.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we've talked about him numerous times, Emperor Basil II.
Yeah.
Basil, however you want to pronounce it, who back then struck a deal with Sambat III, right? Who was of Armenian, Basil II was Armenian descent himself. Yeah. Yet he used this as a leveraging move to integrate the Bakraduni domains into the empire.
Right? No, that's very true. And while some modern historians, like we mentioned, Yuzbashian, view their actions as self-interested, but not as being traitors, others like the 20th century historian Leo are more critical, pointing out that the Byzantine Empire, even under Armenian rule, pursued its own interests, often clashing with the idea of a free and independent Armenia.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, listen, end of the day, I know they say, Basil or Rehan, whatever you want to call him.
Oh, wow. Drop that one.
Anyway, yeah. He was of Armenian descent, but at the end of the day, he was serving Rome.
Oh, yeah.
You can look at it from so many points of view.
He didn't get there as a Trojan horse, man. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I know. But the thing is,
he worked his way up through the ranks there.
Yeah,
it's there you go. It's not like the Armenians planted him and said, all right, when you're at the helm.
There you go. That's exactly where I was trying to get to. Yeah. So, in a way, if it was like Armenia and Byzantine becoming allies, that's one thing. But being completely annexed, I mean, that's...
We'll go into it. But look, Byzantium is the Eastern Roman Empire. It was the continuation of the Roman Empire.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, it basically is the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
They're not going to do, nothing they do is selfless.
Yeah.
This is the bottom line. They're not going to be like, well, no. Armenians, you leave them alone, give them whatever they want. No. This is a Roman Empire.
Of course not. And
they're taking advantage of it any way they can.
A lot of the emperors through Byzantium and Rome, the Caesar, so forth, especially in Byzantium, a lot of them had not just Armenian, other, roots from different type of cultures and stuff. So again, those people were never, like you said, a Trojan horse that was put in there from the, whoever it was, let's say the Armenians, the Persians, the Arabs, whatever, right? Yeah. Nothing. They all were bred and raised within the Roman Empire. They saw themselves as Romans. They didn't care, even from Germany,
So, of course, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's wild how you have all of these, like, this web of
layers, right?
Political struggles, alliances, and whatever you want to call it, right? Like, this whole 200 to 300 year period from the mid 10th century, 11th century, moving into the 12th century, is just too many things going on. I mean, it kind of reminds you of what's going on today, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah, so let's dive a little deeper into these dynamics in our segment. Let's pick up, in 1041 with the Byzantine Emperor Mikhail IV
yes.
and the will of King Sambat III. Yeah, when we say will, we're talking about the actual will he wrote.
Yeah, this is a really important will that Sambat left, and we're going to get into that right now. So Michael IV, or Mikhail IV, upon learning of Sambat III's death, he demanded the fulfillment of Sambat's will, right?
Yeah.
Which the Roman Emperor Basil II basically put pressure on him to make sure this is materialized, right? Or becomes or comes to fruition.
Yeah.
Stated that the kingdom of Armenia would be bequeathed to the Byzantine Empire upon Sambat's death. So that's a really big thing.
The question is, was this will written actually by Sambat, or was it, was he blackmailed something? Because Sambat, you know, obviously, I don't think he was that naive to just, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like something.
But here's the problem. Michael, or Mikhail IV's death in December of 1041 put a temporary hold on Armenia's annexation. It wasn't until Emperor Constantine IX's reign from 1042 to 1055 that this issue resurfaced.
Right. According to Matthew of Edessa, who we've mentioned many times before, historian, a key figure in this was Vestsatkis. He's the one who supposedly urged the emperor to summon Gagik II to Constantinople, more or less under false pretenses, or, you know, whatever the case is, kind of lured him, dangled the carrot to making the annexation of Ani a lot easier.
It was quite.
That's kind of, sorry to cut you off, that's kind of like the starting point of all this.
Yeah, that's right? Very true. That's quite the type of strategy, and both Matthew of Edessa and other historians, Aristakis Lastiverti, we've mentioned many times, viewed Vestsatkis and Catholicos Peter the First as the treacherous, trying to manipulate the young King Gagik the Second, which I kind of see that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you see someone else come into the reign, right? And you're now, if you've probably been in politics or been involved in the situation for quite longer, and now a new face comes in.
Yeah.
Well, let's see how we can manipulate this, right? But we can't overlook the fact that King Gagik the Second probably had his own intentions and own ideologies and whatever his capabilities, right?
Yeah.
He was very quick to act against Vestsatkis by removing him from the self-appointed regency and later capturing him at the fortress of Surmadi. So this guy, you know, self-appointed himself something.
Yeah.
Very powerful, thinking that he can take control or take advantage of this power vacuum, which is what always happens whenever you have a great leader pass away.
But here's the thing. Even after capturing Sarkis, Gagik II showed leniency, pardoning him when he expressed remorse. excuse me. However, Aristakis Lastiverzis criticized that this as a naive move by Gagik II, given Sarkis's ongoing policy of national treason.
Yeah, as you could see, there's more complexity to all these politics that are playing out, right? Loyalties being severed and strengthened on multiple sides, different strategies at play. Gagik and his decisions and whatnot, whether he's naive or forgiving, had a significant impact on almost everything that's going to play out moving forward.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the intrigue and power struggle of this period is just fascinating.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it's going to get pretty wild as we talk about this.
It kind of offers a glimpse into the, you can call it the challenging decisions the leaders during this time faced in medieval Armenia, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, after dealing with internal politics, Gagik II turned his attention to the Seljuk Turk raiders. this was a significant shift, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, yeah. Gagik II reinforced the army. He had to, obviously.
Yeah.
Because the threat was from the east, right? With the Seljuks. They scored a notable victory close to Lake Sevan, where Gagik and Sparap at Varampalavuni cleverly split their forces, leading to a major defeat for the Seljuks.
Yeah, yeah. Meanwhile, Emperor Constantine the Ninth was still eyeing Armenia.
Mm-hmm.
He used Sambat the Third's will as a pretext for annexation and even entered negotiations with Varam Sparapet, but he was after direct control, yeah. not just suzerainty, basically.
Yeah, he wanted full control, no share, yeah. no share yeah. and caring.
Yeah.
And then I guess the negotiations ended up failing.
Of course.
Constantine the Ninth resorted to military force, of course, sending General Michael Lasitis, if I pronounced that correctly. However, the Byzantine forces were met with stiff resistance from the Armenians.
That's right.
So now they're dealing with them and them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Here we go.
And there's more intrigue with Vesarkis, who was pardoned by Gagik II. Reports suggest he and Catholicos Peter.
We sounded like the news.
Yeah, yeah. Reports suggest he and Catholicos Peter I played a role in luring Gagik II to Constantinople under the guise of a peace treaty.
Yes.
They
always dangle that carrot, yeah, right?
It's kind of like what's happening right now, right?
Peace. So yeah, in Constantinople, where it seems like everything happens at this time, Gagik II refused to abdicate, leading to his house arrest. So they didn't let him go back.
Yeah.
Maybe. Back in Armenia, this caused significant resentment, especially when Constantine the Ninth's general Nicholas led a new expedition to finish the annexation. So they really wanted this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
They really wanted this. So he's sending multiple people after this.
Yeah, yeah. And after the annexation, Gagik II was recognized as the ruler of Majak by Emperor Constantine the Ninth. He even defended the Armenian church in a theological debate with the emperor in Constantinople.
Yes. And
it's like, so you annex it, but you recognize him as the ruler of
there has to be more context to this. Unfortunately, we don't have that, but there had to be some backroom deals or something. Something's yeah. going on.
Yeah.
There's just some stuff where you're like, your brain starts thinking about like, okay, what happened there?
Well, don't forget also you're dealing with an 18-year-old kid.
Sure. Sure.
With how many different type of, call it the
wolves
the
and sharks.
Sharks, yeah. you know, chirping in his ear yeah. and.
Yeah. He got an earful for sure.
Yeah.
Meanwhile in Ani, mm-hmm. okay, there was
talk. Camera shifts.
Meanwhile in Ani, there was talk of crowning a new king. But Catholicus Peter I, who was actively campaigning to hand over the kingdom to the Byzantines, a move that contemporary historians likened to Judas's betrayal of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. The fall of the Bagratuni kingdom in 1045 marked a significant shift. The Kars and Tashi offshoots lasted a bit longer, but eventually met similar fates.
Yeah, and finally, the Bagratuni house continued to hold power in the kingdom of Georgia until 1801.
Yeah.
That I didn't know, actually.
Yeah.
I don't think we've ever covered anything like that or talked about that.
We kind of touched on it.
Maybe, but I forgot. But that's
a long time.
Yeah, man. But in Georgia, you know.
19th century.
Yeah, right. Which is right before Georgia, I think, got annexed by Russia. Yeah,
yeah that's true.
So it's a long, complex legacy left by the Bagratuni house, stretching across centuries and empires.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. A saga of resilience, intrigue, and shifting mm-hmm. Alliances, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
As we are unveiling the complexities of Armenian history during the end of the Bagratuni family rule, let's talk about the Byzantine annexation. Ani became the seat of the Byzantine governors.
Yes. So the first governor was Nicholas A. Okay, got it.
Good luck with this.
Yeah. Parakoimomenos. Nicholas, a Parakoimomenos, meaning he was a highly trusted courtier and head of the emperor's personal bodyguard.
Wow.
Yes. Under him was General Michael Lasides, who we just previously mentioned, who led military campaigns in the region. So there you've got their plants. Placing their pieces.
Now, speaking of military campaigns, there was a significant event involving the Shadaid Emir of Dvin.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, at this time, Dvin was under the control of the Arabs, right?
Yeah.
So, Abul Answar.
Yes. So, in 1045, General Michael attacked Dvin, but Abul Answar cleverly used irrigation canals. This was interesting.
Yeah.
To flood the plains, trapping the Byzantines and inflicting heavy losses. Like, how? I was curious. I'm trying to picture this, and it's really interesting how that would work, right?
Like, I mean, if you look at the map of Dvin, like, I don't think there's
their path.
I don't think there's it shows the canals or anything for you to visually. But
no,
I
of
mean,
course not.
He did it.
Yeah. So, anyways, we managed to maintain control over Dvin and even extended his influence to Ganzak.
Yeah. Now, meanwhile, in Armenia, Naharar's now subjects to the Byzantine Empire were drawn into these conflicts, obviously. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, Varan Pahlavuni and many others fell during this assault on Dvin.
Yeah.
They had no choice but to be part of the Byzantine. They had to go. At the end of the day, that was Armenia, Armenian lands, Armenian city. And that's how they lost their lives.
Well, as we're so used to tragic turns in events and whatnot for Armenian leaders. Around 1049, the Byzantines tried to again capture Dvin, led by Nikephoros, a high-ranking court member. They managed to push Abul Answar to renew Byzantine suzerainty, but couldn't fully capture Dvin.
Yeah, yeah. The resistance was crucial as it helped preserve the independence of the smaller Armenian realms in Syunik, Dashid, and Artsakh, which hadn't been annexed by the Byzantines yet.
Yeah.
Artsakh. Again, we're talking about, what year is this?
1040s, 1050s.
1045, somewhere around there.
But, they like to make things up.
Yes.
I'll leave it at that. But anyway, so while all this kerfuffle is happening,
you said that word again.
I did. Yeah. I did. I like that word. The Seljuks are starting to kind of move forward and gain strength and whatnot. The first large scale raid into Byzantine held Armenia began around 1048, led by Seljuk leaders Kutlumush ibn Arslan and Ibrahim Inal.
Yeah, yeah. Butchered
that, but it's okay. They're Seljuk, so who cares?
Let's not forget the Seljuks posed a threat not just to the Byzantines, but also to the Shadadites.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the Seljuks dynasty was founded by Seljuk ibn Dukak and Oğuz Turkic. I guess Oğuz, that's how you say it? Oğuz Turkic warlord.
Yeah.
There were threat. They didn't care.
No,
Arab,
of course they didn't care.
Armenian,
nope.
Roman, Byzantine, whatever.
Well, I mean, this is, kind of going off topic here. This is the beginnings of what eventually turned out to be the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're 450 years prior to that time period, but
this is where
these are the people. These are the same people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so the Turkmens, including the Seljuks, and they were basically nomadic people. We already know that.
Yeah.
Constantly moving in search of grazing lands. This was what was cause for warfare back then, no matter what. There are raids into the Armenian lands like Vaspurakan date back as early as like 1015 or 1016, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of where they started to have a little bit of like, shake the globe a little bit, so to speak.
Yeah. It's kind of fascinating how these nomadic insurgents intersected with the kind of, like, you can call it the established civilization, right?
Yeah.
Leading to significant clashes and shifting powers,
mm-hmm.
and dynamics in this region.
Well, it always has been. It's always been the case.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's never been a settled area of, you know, well, these are our lands.
Yeah.
It's always been somebody from some direction, somewhere else. Something goes away, someone else comes up. Yeah. And the only reason they go away is because someone else came through.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, I mean, the whole time period is marked with, like, military campaigns and, like, it just feels like it was just nonstop war and dirty politics. And
I mean, this just shows the complexity of medieval Armenia.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you know, the politics, the warfare. But let's talk more about the Seljuk Turks and their rise to power. It all starts with Chieftain Seljuk.
Yes.
Right.
So the Seljuks Seljuk initially served in the Khazar army. That's a very interesting point for me. I think I might do a little bit of deep dive into that one for myself. Into the Khazar army before migrating to Jend in Khwarezm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Around 985, Seljuk and his followers converted to Islam. His son Musa and nephews Tughril and Chagri founded a state around the Aral Sea basin in 1037.
Yeah, yeah. It's also interesting to note that Seljuks were pretty, Seljuks transitioned from paganism to Islam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they faced setbacks too, like the defeat by Ali Tegin, I guess.
That's
what it is. We're going to butcher these. And the Karahanids,
mm-hmm.
forcing Tughril and Chagri to move towards Khorasan and Iran.
Yeah, and the Seljuks were very, I mean, you know, they were really, really aggressive with their marches forward and with their military campaigns. Not just, they weren't attacking just the Armenians, but like you mentioned, Persians, Kurds, Arabs, everybody.
Yeah, they didn't care.
They didn't care. Yeah, they were just savages. So the raids were brutal. Involved a lot of destruction usually, right?
Yeah.
Pillaging, as we've mentioned before. Yeah.
Now, speaking of raids, the Seljuks started targeting Armenia in the 1030s.
Mm-hmm.
There were significant invasions like the one led by Qutalmish around 1045, where they defeated the Byzantine commander, Stefan Lechudos. I don't know how you pronounce that.
Lechudis.
Yeah.
And then, there was a raid under Tughril's nephew.
Tughril's nephew.
Yeah. Hassan the Deaf. Which was
Deaf?
No, man.
Hassan the Deaf? I don't know.
I don't know, whatever. But if he was deaf, that'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Despite initial successes, Hassan was killed in an ambush near Lake Van, marking a setback for the Seljuks.
You didn't hear him coming.
You stole that from me. Damn you, I was about to say it. You were waiting on that one, weren't you? You didn't hear him coming.
I had to.
It was a silent night.
It was a very silent. So bad.
Stop. Okay.
Okay.
Moving forward.
Yeah. Fast forwarding to 1048 to 1049, and we see another major Seljuk raid into Byzantine Armenia. Ibrahim Yinal, commanding the large Seljuk force, managed to score victory at the Battle of Basin.
Yeah, the battle was significant. The Byzantines were outnumbered and diverted much of their forces to deal with internal revolts. That's kind of interesting, right? Yeah, like, I wonder why that would be the case, like whether it was weather conditions or whatever it was. But despite orders to avoid action, the Byzantine troops camped at Basin. Or Basin, however you pronounce it, while the civilians sought refuge in fortresses, which is typical for them to do.
Yeah, yeah. And Skylitis, we pronounce him, adds that the Seljuk army included Daylamites, mm-hmm. and Khurasani Iranians, showing the diverse composition of their forces.
Yeah, they're like little tribes.
But you think they invaded
factions?
I think they invaded, and like these people had no choice but
converted
them. They converted them, and maybe. You know, I mean,
could be. I mean, it was typical practice back then for people to invade your lands and then take control of your military.
But that's what I'm saying, because I don't see the Persians are just willingly joining. I don't know, like they're proud people, and
of course.
I'm assuming, again, this is all, this can correct me if I'm wrong, or maybe let us know. But I just don't see them just getting now, up and joining the Seljuks.
But now here's an interesting thing I'll throw at you. And I have no proof of this. This is just mere speculation based on the past. Is if there is a big group like or empire like the Byzantine Empire, the Roman Empire, and the Persians were always trying to battle them with Armenia in the middle.
Yeah.
Now you get the Seljuks who come through and maybe built some alliances with a lot of these Persians in the area and said, hey, we want to go keep going west.
Yeah.
Right?
With the small tribes. But see, I get what you're saying.
Like,
but
what's the saying? Like, your enemy is like the enemy of my friend.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that, so, right?
Well, here's the thing. Yes, obviously that could have happened.
Just speculation.
But the thing is, don't forget, Iran or Persia at that time, you know, it was a big empire. They were proud people. So it seems like these were probably offshoot tribes that maybe didn't really blend in well with the rest of the Persian Empire. Maybe that's how it is. But at least my assumption is that I think they were just conquered, and like they had some warriors and stuff, and the Seljuks went, okay.
Yeah, they capitulated.
They're like, hey, okay, now you're going to fight for us.
Well, I mean, it could work that way.
Yeah.
You know, but in that situation, you're not going to go kill whoever you're going up against. You're not going to go kill all that military because you could use those bodies. You know what I mean?
Who knows?
You're not going to go wipe out their military.
We need that time machine.
Yes. Anyway, so tragically, the raid, of course, had devastating consequences. Ibrahim took a large number of captives, drastically affecting the human trafficking markets in the Middle East.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting.
Right? Mm. Well, the human trafficking goes back.
Oh, of course it does. This is nothing new.
In thousands of years. So, obviously. Know. But, I mean, the first slavery.
Well, I mean, goes back millennia.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, there's also the siege of Artsin, right? Despite heroic resistance by the Armenians, the city fell to the Seljuks. The scale of the massacre and destruction was immense, with reporting coming from news anchors around 150,000 deaths, though this might be an exaggeration, but that's the estimate.
Reporting live from the hillsides or the historians who were watching the wars.
Yeah, yeah.
Writing in their little diaries. Anyway, so it was a pretty grim time in the story of Artsin and Ani.
Yeah.
And Rars, because these areas were highly impacted with a lot of devastation.
Yeah.
A lot.
Very true. The Seljuk invasions brought profound changes, reshaping the political and demographic landscape of the region.
Mm-hmm.
But let's discuss the battle involving the combined Byzantine and Georgian army and the Seljuks on the plains of Basin.
Yeah, so you see, this is just another episode of how... We're mentioning there's alliances being made.
Yeah.
And then there's so much political strife and everybody's kind of linking up with one another and then dividing amongst one another and whatever the case is. It's pretty wild stuff.
Yeah.
So historians like Ibn al-Atij and Aristakis Lastiverzi estimate the Byzantine Georgian army to have been around 50 to 60,000 men.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's quite a large army.
Yeah.
However, a significant moment was when Liparit IV commanding the Georgian troops refused to fight on a Saturday, leading to a delay and allowing the Seljuks to form battle lines. I wonder how that request was relayed.
He works only on wholesale hours.
But hear me out here. How, on Friday night, okay, how did Liparit get the message to the Seljuks, who were basically just breaking everything and, you know, tearing everything to shreds? It's like, hey, hold on. Guys, I can't fight tomorrow. Okay, let's hold off for another 24 hours. How did that happen?
I have no idea. I mean, couriers, I don't know.
Daughter had a soccer game.
Yeah. She had a tournament. Got to be there. Hey.
Sorry, bro. I can't make it.
Yeah. This delay proved costly.
Of course it did.
Yeah. The battle began in the evening and lasted all night. Aaron and Kekaumanes.
Kekaumenos.
And commanding the Byzantine flanks, each defeated the Turks. But in the center, Ibrahim captured Liparit, disrupting the Byzantine-Georgian coordination.
I mean, he asked for some time.
Yeah.
And he still came up short.
Probably was hungover from partying.
Whatever, man. Yeah. Like, I just still don't get it. Like, And you know what? No, I'm not going to say it. I was going to say, and God, look at how nice the Seljuks were.
Yeah.
To give them another 24 hours, then delay the inevitable. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It's like, well, it's anyway. Okay. We know what we're going to do to you. So we'll wait another 24 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Aaron and despite some of these interesting setbacks, Aaron and Kekaumenos remained unaware of Liparit's capture. They thought he was pursuing the enemy and only learned the truth later on.
Yeah, and the aftermath, I should say, was a mixed result. The Byzantines had some success, but the capture of Liparit and Ibrahim's escape with Armenian captives set the stage for further Seljuk incursions and conquests in Byzantine Armenia.
Yeah, once they had that little crack in the wall, that was that, right?
Yeah.
So then there's other subsequent raids, specifically one in 1054, starting with Kutalmish ibn Arslan's raid on Gars. As we mentioned before, despite looting much of the city, they couldn't breach the citadel.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, they got there, but they can't crack that nut quite yet.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Tugril himself launched an invasion later that year, sacking cities along Lake Van, but they faced fierce resistance, notably the Babert from Norse mercenaries serving the Byzantines. These Norsemen basically even managed to kill the Seljuk commander.
Yeah, don't mess with the Norsemen.
Yeah.
Yep. And
I don't know much about the Norsemen.
I don't either. They just sound pretty fierce.
Yeah, just don't mess with them.
Yeah.
But good on them.
Seljuks found out the hard way.
Yeah.
Also, there was the Battle of Vanand, where Armenian King Gagik of Gars and his army inflicted significant losses on the Seljuks. I mean, yeah, they drove through. They did, as history has told us they did. But, you know, it wasn't like we were cowering down. There was definitely a lot of resistance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They weren't going to let them just walk all over them.
No, no. Yeah. And then there is also a notable story of one of the Armenian noblemen, Tatul of Vanand.
Yes.
Who was, I think, killed by the Seljuks, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, he was wounded. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was wounded, but tragically, Tatul was captured and later executed when the chieftain's son died, basically. So moving on, right? Turil's attempt to take Karin was unsuccessful, and he turned towards Manazakert.
Yeah. Manaskert was very well fortified.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Seljuks brought their huge catapults.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but faced very stiff resistance. The defenders used primitive forms. Well, these are, according to historical accounts, used primitive forms of Molotov cocktails or like incendiary devices. I mean, I do know that this was very, very popular back in those days, is to burn things because they had different types of oils and things like that. Yeah. So
the early usage of incendiary weapons is quite notable. Mm-hmm. The Armenians also used smaller catapults and iron hooks to dislodge Seljuk horsemen, showing their ingenuity in defense.
Well, yeah, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
Light something on fire and chuck it at things. Yeah. In the end, Tughril withdrew from Armenia this resistance. Yeah, but the Seljuk ambition to conquer Armenia did not go away.
Yeah, yeah. A period marked by fierce battles, strategic maneuvers, and resilient defense strategies. Now, delving deeper into the Seljuk Turks' impact on Armenia, in 1055, you could see it as a pivotal year with Tughril captured
Baghdad.
Yeah,
you know? Baghdad, obviously, back then was such a center hub. Right, throughout history, especially during the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th centuries. I know we're not talking about that portion of the world historically, everyone knows. It was a cultural hub to everything.
Yeah.
So Tughril's conquest of Baghdad was a significant victory, of course. It provided the Seljuks with resources that would later fuel their campaigns against the Byzantines moving forward, and among others.
Yeah. Yeah. And from 1055 to 1062, Seljuk raids intensified in Armenia, causing severe damage to towns and villages and leading to many Armenians being killed or captured.
Yeah. And this is where the fall of Ani comes in, more or less.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's mainly because of the Seljuks. In 1064, to Alp Arslan. The city was massacred, with Ibn al-Atir reporting that the corpses were so numerous, and I quote, that the Muslim forces couldn't enter the city.
Yeah, yeah. This set a stage for Alp Arslan's major invasion in 1068, culminating in the Battle of Manaskert in 1071. This defeat was catastrophic for the Byzantines and paved the way for Seljuk's expansion into Asia Minor.
Yeah.
So this is kind of where it began.
Yeah, I mean, this is the spawn of the Seljuks basically kind of taking control and sweeping through that area, moving north and west.
They never gave up.
No, because they probably didn't die. They multiplied, bro. Who knows how many.
But I mean, for almost 400 years, they didn't stop. They had to take Byzantine. They had to take Constantinople. You know, like it was just.
They went and they swept through. Yeah. And then eventually, of course, these are the predecessors to the Ottomans. And we all know how far the Ottomans went into what used to be the Eastern Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The victory at Manaskert cement for the Seljuks cemented the Turkic presence in the region for centuries to come.
Yeah.
Many Armenian cities were looted, churches destroyed, and the population suffered greatly. Yeah. Again, if you really think about this time period moving forward from the 11th century to the 15th century, that's 400 years. They basically cemented themselves into eventually becoming the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, yeah. Alp Arslan then allowed his Turkmen chieftains to establish their own principalities in former Byzantine Armenia. Mm-hmm. This led to the rise of various Turkmen dynasties in the region.
Yeah, and I mean this basically took wiping out Armenian strongholds in our lands.
Yeah. And that's where
spawn their eventual rise to power.
I mean, if you guys can imagine, we're talking about the year 1071, right?
Yeah.
So So almost getting into the, you can call it the 12th century. From there on, this is where Armenia has been under pretty much Turkic rule.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it all began from here.
Yeah.
And we, yeah, we're going to get into the Cilician, you know, we'll kingdom get, yeah, and we'll this and that. But the Cilician kingdom, that region was
further south, southwest,
but that entire other area.
Oh yeah. Completely occupied.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's where it all began.
Yeah.
In 1072, Alp Arslan sold the ruins of Ani to Abul Aswar, the emir of Devin and Ganzak. His son Manuchir, who was part Bagraduni, interestingly enough, tried to improve relations with the Armenian population, but I can imagine where the majority of his loyalties lied.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, Manuchir's efforts were notable. He even established a separate bishopric seat for Ani. However, the city changed hands multiple times between the Bagratunis of Georgia and then the Shaddadid dynasty. Yeah. So, you know, so many back and forths.
And during this time, enter a new character, Queen Tamar of Georgia. She played a significant role under her reign. Ani was captured and governed by the Armenian generals, Zakare and Ivan.
Yeah.
Now, Ivan. Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. But
and that
we
name,
talked about the Zakarians.
Yes.
We mentioned it. But yes. The Zakarian dynasty, claiming descent from the Bagratunis, brought prosperity back to Ani. They even managed to hold off the Mongols in 1226.
The Seljuks.
That's a big task,
Seljuks,
right?
Cousins.
Yeah. But then the city was eventually sacked in 1236. Yeah. So for 10 years, they put up a stronghold and didn't let them come in. But, you know, I mean, when you're dealing with a force that keeps multiplying, it's like that zombie movie you see. Just they never stop coming.
Go away because they wanted it. Yeah. They wanted it all.
It just came and came and came.
Wave after wave.
Yeah. Yeah.
With their cousins.
Yeah. Cousins.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know? Well, Ani, beyond all of this, you know, tug of war going on, was also suffering natural disasters. Suffered a major earthquake in 1319.
Yeah.
But Ani still continued to exist, even with its diminished grandeur.
Yeah.
Its history definitely is a testament of time. Resilience. Shifting power struggles. God, if Ani had a mouth.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about Ani multiple times. We had, you know, Dr. Christina Marantzian. We've talked about Ani. Ani's story reflects broader narrative of Armenia during this time, this era. Let's talk about the Zakarians a little bit.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Okay. So the Zakarians ruled until 1360. Ani came under control of the Jalayrids and the Karakoyunlu Confederation. But the Mongol invasions and later Turkmen incursions led many of Ani's inhabitants to migrate to various parts of Europe.
Yeah.
So they scattered.
That's pretty much where the diaspora, you can call it the Armenian diaspora,
initial
started.
Forms
of it. Spreading from Poland to Holy Roman Empire. Then Ani fell under Persian Safavid rule in the early 16th century, later becoming part of the Ottoman Empire in 1579.
By about the mid 17th century, Ani had more or less kind of gingivelled.
Yeah.
From its previous days, you know, didn't really stand for much. Was more or less completely abandoned by 1735. Last monks left the Virgin's Fortress Monastery around that time.
Yeah. Well, you know, despite these crazy times, Armenian statehood persisted.
Yep.
In some form, in some way. They didn't give up.
Yeah, and this is this is where they scattered southwest, I guess let's call it that, right? And then formed, and then, you know, you're talking about kingdoms like Sunik and Artsakh continued until the 12th and 13th centuries, respectively. But the principalities that I'm talking about were Lesser Armenia and Kilikia.
Yeah.
Or Cilicia.
Yeah. Actually, that's an important point. After the fall of the Bagratuni kingdom, we see figures like King Gagik II Bagratuni, who died at Majak in 1079. So while all this stuff was happening, you know, he was still around as kind of called
it. He was a relevant figure.
Still a leader in Majak because he was appointed as the leader of Majak by Constantine the Ninth. So he died in Majak in 1079, and then Ruben of the house of Bagratuni established the principality of Cilician Armenia.
Yes. And that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to that, the principality evolved into the restored kingdom of Armenia under King Levon the Magnificent in 1198, signifying a revival of Armenian independence and sovereignty.
That's right. The kingdom of Armenia in Cilician Armenia lasted until the first half of the 15th century, with some areas holding out until 1448. And the cities like Zeytun maintained Armenian autonomy even until the early 20th century.
Further proof of our resilience and you know, our ability to, all right, well, one thing ended, let's go start another one.
Yeah.
You know, just doesn't end. It's, I mean, it's a horrible cycle. I wish it wasn't like this, but
just
don't go away.
You know, that's one thing about the Armenian story as a people. If you were to describe the history of as a people, you know, with just certain words, you can say endurance, right?
Yeah.
Resilience, reinnovation.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing about Armenians that I've noticed through all these episodes we've done, and we've talked about so many historical periods, and you know, it's like we have these hey moments, like, oh my god, the greater Armenia or the kings and this, and then the fall of it. Yeah,
proud moments and not so proud moments.
But after every fall of an empire, a kingdom, a dynasty, they, you know, it's like, it's almost like, it's like a, it's a rebirth, you know, rejuvenation.
Mm-hmm.
And you almost come back. You haven't really died, but
no.
It's like you kind of went and rejuvenate yourself and you come back and you start new, fresh, but you still keep that Armenian, you know, pride and love for your country, for your land and everything. And that's kind of, I think, what we're experiencing right now with the loss of Artsakh. I think this is the period where Armenia is going to rejuvenate itself, reestablish itself, reinvent itself, I think, to be stronger. To be more independent and to have allies who are for the best interest of Armenia and not the other way around.
Well, of course.
So I think that's where we're headed to. But, you know, kind of like in a nutshell, this is the information about King Gagik II. Again, there wasn't much about him because he was 18 years old. He came into reign because he had no choice. He was also kind of placed there, if you think about it.
You can't remain leaderless.
Yeah.
Quote unquote.
Yeah.
Right. Without, or landless. you know, you've got all this stuff going on. You needed somebody somewhere. And I'm sure, like you said, I'm sure he was placed, appointed, whatever, selected, however you want to call it.
But I mean, till, you know, you're talking about what, 1079?
Yeah.
That's a long time. So he continued living as a leader, but he wasn't anymore the king of Armenia because Armenia was annexed. But so from here, we're going to go into the Cilician period.
Yes.
There's a lot of research we got to do. We've already started it. We wanted to finish this Bagdatuni period and then move on. So you have to bear with us while we're doing all this research. There's so much
about Kilikia.
We're going to try to dissect it as much as possible. Yeah. We want to talk about certain eras, certain years that certain battles happen, certain characters in there. So we want to tell this story as best as possible.
It's a pretty decent amount of time covered too.
And
with a lot of loyalties and alliances made with many of the Europeans, as we know.
Yeah. So
Knights factions, the Holy Wars.
Yeah. So much happened. So we really want to do justice to the way we tell these stories and the information we're providing to you, that when you guys go look it up, it makes sense. Hopefully we do justice to it. But, you know, a lot of this information, especially before the Cilician, it's so compact.
Yeah.
You know, you're going from this to that to that. There's a lot of...
Well, it's a period in time where there was a lot of information available.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, so a lot of these episodes we covered, I mean, we do what, an average of hour, maybe hour and a half of episode talking about a certain king, certain queen, whatever it is. You know, it's mostly the information is like almost an overview of these bullet points of things that happened to them, they did, achievements, losses, so forth. But within those information, there are other stories that have been never told. So ultimately, our goal is to go back and pick out special stories that there is information about, factual information, and talk about those. But that's it as far as the Bagdatuni dynasty. That was the end of it. So
it was a lot of stuff we covered, man.
We're going to step into a new era.
200 years of quite a bit of information.
Yeah, yeah.
200 plus years.
But... All right, so that's it for this episode. Hope you guys enjoyed it. I hope you learned something. If you guys have any questions, as always, you guys can reach out to us on Instagram, send us a message at MedHedosned, or you can email us, which is pod@medhedosned.com. Again, if you like what we're doing, you enjoy our conversations, our interviews with the guests that we have, consider supporting us on patreon.com/medhedosned. Like I said, next year when we come back, we'll have some interesting stories, guests, more research, and then we'll continue doing what we're doing.
Yeah. And, you know, since Kilikia or Cilicia is quite a popular time frame in our history, right? Yeah. And a lot of people have a lot of information. If you know anybody isn't shy and would like to come hang out and talk about it, let us know.
Again, our show isn't about just having historians on or these intellectual normal people who might be, because there's a lot of people who do crazy research.
We have a lot of like just regular folks. They're not historians, they're not, but they've gone so deep some of this information, it's bewildering sometimes. Yeah,
but here's the thing. I understand some people
y'all want to come out.
Some people might not want to come on a podcast, be on video, but here's the thing. If you have information that you would want us to talk about, bring it to this platform, connect with us, let us know. Point us to the right direction. Whatever information there is that we might have missed or we want us to talk about, just, you know, connect with us and we'll put a nice episode together about it if you're shy to be on camera or to be on the podcast. So, but having said that, again, we want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Take care of yourselves. Be safe.
Yeah.
And as we say at the end of every episode, respect one another.
Love one another.
And till next year. Take care of yourselves.